Hi everyone, welcome to the All Things XR podcast. In today's episode, I have Jerry Ellsworth, CEO of Tilt 5. Hi Jerry.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I'm excited
Thanks
for this.
Very much. Thanks very much. Welcome to the All Things XR podcast. So Jerry, you're one of the, I think, shall we say, legends in the AR and VR field. But for listeners who may not be familiar, could you tell us more about yourself and your background and how did you end up in the XR field?
That could take a full hour, but I'll try to keep it brief. Yeah,
We're all ears.
I've always been a technologist, even since I was a kid, into early home computers. And then in the 90s, I opened a chain of retail computer stores, and it was a pretty amazing time to be selling computers, configuring computers. But then I moved to Silicon Valley, and without going to college, and just on my kind of side experimenting with technology, I brute forced my way into a couple startups, got a reputation of being able to do a good job on electrical engineering, eventually went on to doing chip design, then into the toy industry where I made chips for toys and full product, shipped tens of millions of toys, even worked at rocket companies doing navigation systems to for low Earth orbit rockets. But really what led me to XR was I was recruited into a company called Valve Software. They're a very big distribution platform for PC games. I'm sure anyone listening here probably knows about Steam and Valve, but Gabe Newell, the founder of the company, hired me and gave me the mission to put together a team with the sole mission of finding ways to bring people together in the living room to play games together. He believed the whole family should play games. They shouldn't be in little silos. Like, you've got hardcore PC gamers, you have console players, you have grandma, grandpa that maybe haven't ever played a game. So it was really a dream job. And as we put the team together, we just started exploring everything, you know, potentially that could make games relatable to the entire family. And that's where a lot of XR research started happening at Valve. And that's probably, gosh, that's maybe 13 years ago now. It's been a long time since we started doing that work. Out of all of that, we started to learn a lot about VR and AR. And being at such a big company and with such an important mandate, we were allowed to spend as much money as we wanted. So in the early days to prototype, you know, VR, we were taking a lot of like military technology. Military has always had virtual reality headsets. So we'd buy these insanely expensive VR headsets, and then we would combine them with medical tracking systems where they could track precise movements of like scalpels, and then, you know, just to experience what it was like, what, you know, it could be in 10 years. And it was pretty amazing. We also did the same thing with AR experiences. And that's where I personally got the bug for AR, because it really did fit the mandate of like bringing people together around the table or in the living room. You could see each other eye to eye. You could see your hands and objects. And it was, as we tested on people inside the company and outside the company doing AR, we realized, yeah, you know, non-gamers, like when you put them in kind of spatial experiences, you know, like everyone knows how to pick up a coffee cup. If you can mimic that in kind of a game form using hands or using like a simple thing, like, you know, a 6 degree of freedom controller where you just poke things, anybody could pick it up. So it really did have a broad appeal. Sorry, that was a little long-winded, but that's kind of how, you know, I got my experience. And then, you know, I've done a couple of startups in the AR space, currently running Tilt 5. We've shipped our product that's all about group experiences around the table, you know, continuing that mission that we were given at Valve.
Awesome, awesome. Thanks very much, Jerry. So can you tell us more about Tilt 5? What's your mission and what's the product right now?
Yeah, so There's a lot of factors of why Valve kind of pivoted to what they were doing at the time. So we were doing all this fundamental research, and we were starting to consolidate down into, VR and AR. And Valve didn't want to do AR at this point. There were some external threats to the company that weren't there anymore. So they weren't going to develop this type of augmented reality that I had created there, and I actually bought the technology from them. And I'd fallen in love with the idea of the whole family or groups of people being able to interact. So that's largely our mission, is an economical headset that has a super wide field of view, is very intuitive, and delivers group experiences that are just instant to get into. And so as we started developing our product, here's the headset, lightweight, low cost. You just slip them on. You don't like ratchet anything to your head, no adjustments. That was like one of the criteria. Just a couple seconds to drop into an experience, no calibrations. That was important. And we've achieved that. So, basically our system, it's low cost. Right now we're running our spring sale. It's a couple hundred dollars a headset. Just keep the pricing, simple, like in when you buy a group pack. And you just slip the glasses on and just start playing games.
Awesome. So, if I may recall correctly, you started with Kickstarter, right?
Yes. I've done Kickstarter twice, which is brutal, brutal process.
Can you share about share your experience with running a successful Kickstarter campaign and get us through that experience?
This is a really interesting topic, and I don't think I've discussed this too much publicly. So when I bought the technology from Valve, I started a company called Cast AR, and this was at the height of virtual reality, like everyone was going gaga over it. And Oculus had just done like a phenomenal Kickstarter. They'd raised $1.5 million or $2 million. And so, as we talk to investors, they're like, there's this hot thing called Kickstarter. You just have to go do a Kickstarter. And we were super naive at the time about how to do a Kickstarter. We just kind of made a video, turned it on, and raised like $1 million just like that. It was like really easy back then to raise a bunch of money. And just kind of make a long story short with Cast AR, we ended up during all this hype, we raised a ton of money from, I'd have to say, like bad investors that wanted us to just burn the money as fast as possible. And they brought in all of their external leadership. And so all this money we raised and all this Kickstarter money that we raised, evaporated really quickly. The cool thing that we did, our investors didn't want us to do the original concept of the product that we pitched on Kickstarter. So we refunded all the money to the Kickstarter backers. And thank goodness we did, because once they started bringing in like Disney executives to run the company and they burned through $15 million in like less than a year, it would have been very embarrassing for me to have like taken money from people and then not delivered a product. So ultimately, this company it ended very quickly, and it was really tragic. But we had developed the core technology during this time, and it was still really good and solid. So a group of us bought the assets from the company and started again. But this time, we'd learned some valuable lessons. Like, you don't ever want to outsource running your company to outside people. Like, it should be the founders, the people that see the vision, and just staying on the pulse of like how fast you're spending money. So when we started Tilt 5, couple interesting things. Now we're in, if you look at the Gartner hype cycle, like VR was over, right? We were down in the trough of despair, or whatever they call it. So there was no money available to XR companies at the time. So we bootstrapped the company like $100,000 at a time, just little dribs and drabs of money. We got the product working really well. And having done the Kickstarter before, I thought it was really difficult and we hadn't put a lot of work into it. But in the meantime, like a few years had gone by and there had been a lot of Kickstarter scams and a lot had been learned about Kickstarter. So as we started to run out of money and we had the product kind of in our hands to demonstrate, we had to do something to prove market fit. And investors are like, why don't you try a Kickstarter? If you do great on a Kickstarter, we'll certainly put money into you. So we got ourselves backed into the corner doing Kickstarter again. And we'd been monitoring what was going on with Kickstarter, and we're like, it's not like the old days where you could just make a video and raise a million or $2. Like, we actually had to put 3 or 4 months of work in advance of the Kickstarter, and we had to create an audience, so we got our social media going and teased that something exciting was coming, and we collected thousands of people on social media, and which was good. This is really, I'm really happy we did this because it really cemented what we were doing in the company, because we really had to think about every aspect of our business and how we were going to present it. Then we started working on the assets to go into the Kickstarter. So we put a lot of thought into like everything that we put into the video, into the text, what we were promising. And then we built up to the launch date. And at this point, we had, I don't know, $50,000 in the bank. Like, and it was really a moment. We took all of our chips and we pushed them forward and we just put it all into the Kickstarter. Like, everyone that was working, it was like three of us. We didn't take wage or anything. We just put all money into Kickstarter and marketing it. And we ended up being the largest ever AR project on Kickstarter. But it was brutal. I mean, we were taking turns staying up 24 hours a day, like answering questions. And having failed in a startup, there's a little baggage that comes along with that. In venture capital, ironically, raising money, failing in a startup is like a benefit. People are like, well, you learned a lot. But public facing, there's it's a negative. And so we were 24 hours a day, like trying to like manage, perceptions, like we're not a scam. We went to lots of events. We're flying all over the place, like showing the product it's real, and answering questions and answering like why things went wrong at the previous startup. And anyway, it worked out. But I think every one of us, like on the last day, it was over, it was successful, and then we all got sick. Just like, I think all the adrenaline, everything collapsed, and we were like sick for a week, like massively sick.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Jay. So, can you tell us more about the actual headset and what's the difference between Tilt5's approach to XR and similar products like Quest and Apple Vision Pro and etc.?
So our headset works completely different than almost anything else out there. So when you look at kind of the full spectrum of XR headsets out there, they kind of fall into a couple buckets. So the two big buckets is you have, a VR type device, and it's a screen and a lens or two in front of your eyes, and that puts the light directly into your eyes. You're isolated from the world with this. You can augment that by putting some cameras on it, to have video pass through, and that's developed in the last couple of years. Those devices are all fixed focus. That means that the light that you're seeing is focused at infinity. So, like, way out on the horizon, the light rays are coming in, in a straight line into your eyes. So there's a thing called vergence accommodation. This is where your eyes converge in to look at a virtual object, but the light rays, are coming from somewhere else. It's pretty stressful on quite a few people's eyes, and it takes, a lot of training to like get acclimated to that and, Everyone's heard of ER sickness and just eye strain after 20, 30 minutes, and some people are more sensitive to others. So there's that bucket. Then there's AR devices, which typically consist of, an image source that's not directly in front of your eyes and some kind of relay optics that brings it out towards your eyes and a world combiner. So it takes the light that's coming from the world, it transmits through this combiner, and then it also combines the image coming from the image generator and superimposes it on top of the world. Almost 100% of those are fixed focus as well. So they do suffer from some eye fatigue problems. There are some pretty interesting kind of varifocal and light field technologies out there. They're super limited today, where you can compute different focal depths and present that to the user. Magic Leap 1 actually was that. It had a couple different focal depths to it, but each one of these focal depths, you're just adding a lot of cost to the system. And they eventually dropped it because it was too costly and difficult to make. So that's how those technologies work. One thing to mention about AR that's challenging is in AR, where the light's from the real world's transmitting through this world combiner, you're fighting the real world light. So usually they look pretty washed out. And also, just because of the laws of physics, you can't bend light in a really tight space very quickly. So, if it's a compact headset, those experiences usually are a very small field of view. So you have a little postage stamp that's floating out in front of you, and not very immersive. HoloLens, Magic Leap, Nreal, like all of these kind of suffer from those limitations. So what I discovered at Valve, and it was a pure accident, I was actually working on an AR system with a world combiner on an optics bench. So it was this whole spread out thing, on little posts, and I'm trying to solve vergence accommodation, trying to get a wide field of view. And one day I put the world combiner, which was just a very simple like beam splitter, in backwards. So instead of like bending the light towards my eye, I projected it out into the lab. And one of my colleagues that was working on a tracking system had a piece of this special material called a retro reflector hanging on the wall that he was bouncing lasers off of. And I saw this beautiful image, 3D image, sitting out there on this screen, really far away, like many, many meters away. It was beautiful. It looked really cool. It was a very strange effect. And I'm like, that's weird. And then I flipped the beam splitter back and I continued with my work. And this, I continued on this path of trying to do traditional AR for months and months. And it became apparent to me, what I really needed to have a great AR experience is some space. And that's when it came to me, just like a light bulb moment. What if I just split the optical system in half? We were talking about like how do you get the family to kind of come together and have a shared experience? Why don't we do it like a campfire, where you put some of this reflective material, roll it out on the table, you project a light field from the glasses to the special reflector that takes the light and brings it back directly to each user, and each user can generate their light field. And so I prototyped it up and it looked beautiful. And the cool property of this is wherever this reflective material is, you can have an AR experience. So you can roll it out on your table, you can pin it to the wall, and you get to generate a light field that your eyes can focus at all these depths without having to add hardware to do it or to calculate all these distances. It's just a property of how this material works. And I was sold on it. And that's what I ultimately bought from Valve. And that's the core to our technology. The cool thing about it is, like, if we want to make a headset that has narrow field of view, piece of cake, wide field of view, whatever resolution we want, there's like almost no limitations to how you can configure this, depending on the market that you're going after. Sorry again, I'm rambling. I can go, if you get me talking about optics, I can go all day long. One of my passions.
Exactly. That's one of my questions. What are the biggest challenges in bringing Tilt 5's headset from the idea, the prototype, to the mass market? and shipping the product.
I mean, the challenges are multifaceted. It's like everything. The XR space hasn't recovered from, the hype. It's better now. Like, so for us, it's always been challenging to raise enough money. So our system really benefits from having lots of software and having a great headset. And so we've always been pretty cash constrained. We have some pretty cool software on it. I would love to put $100 million into like finding our Mario Kart and our like whatever, all these different genres of games. But until things mature a little bit more and more developers create software, that's going to slow us down a tiny bit. We did the Kickstarter and we were about ready to go into production and COVID hit. That was a terrible, like, it took a full extra year before we got our first samples off the production line. So that was interesting trying to deal with that. There's so many challenges. Awareness is always a challenge for us. It comes back to dollars. It's always dollars. Like if I had $100 million to put into marketing, people would be more aware of our product too. So, yeah.
Got it. So, Jerry, you talked about your experience and how you approach to developing the products. What keeps you motivated and driven to continue creating and innovating in this evolving industry?
I think I've always had that motivation. I think as a kid, I always dreamed of like being an inventor and like selling products and stuff like that. And so at my core, it's there. When I worked in the toy industry, that was the first time I started working on projects that I was immensely proud of. Prior to the toy industry, I had worked on some stuff I was proud of. Like I designed some chips that ended up in the TiVo, which is a video recorder. It's probably not much of a thing these days, but it was a really hard project and I was proud of it. But once I actually built a product that I could go to the store shelf and point to, people were like, I love this toy, or my kids love this toy, that really like brought it to a new level. And so with Tilt 5, I just came back from Computex, which is one of Taiwan's largest trade shows for consumer electronics and PC devices. Going to trade shows and showing this to people that have never seen it before is very, very satisfying. It keeps me going. Like when things get rough, there's always like a trade show right around the corner. I'm like, all right, we're doing the right thing, because it's almost universal. People are like, that was better than I expected. That was awesome. And we see it in sales too. So every time we get exposure, our sales spike. And so that's really, really satisfying. And we've been going, I mean, we're coming on 7 years now. It's kind of amazing. Like, I don't think I ever worked on a project. No, I'm absolutely certain I haven't worked on a project this long. So
That's
that's
long.
how much I believe in it. And having worked in lots of startups too, there's always in startups, especially if it's kind of a meh product, there's always a lot of turnover. And our team, through all the ups and downs, like in the early days, we were just like moments from like running out of money. People stuck by us, people took furloughs, and very little turnover in our company. So it's really cool to see other engineers and personnel in the company so committed to it.
Awesome, thanks, Cherry. So, can you tell us more about the challenges of being a hardware and entrepreneur? I myself, as someone who's always been active in the software field, won't go near hardware in any situation. Can you tell us about the challenges of being a hardware entrepreneur?
This is it's interesting. It's difficult to raise money for hardware, and it's a little irrational. When you talk to investors about hardware, they're spooked of it. But from my perspective, I've always worked in hardware, and I know what to look for good hardware engineers. They're very disciplined, unlike software, and I'm not trying to disparage software, but hardware, you really have to like be very diligent up front, and you're never going to get everything perfect. But I feel like with the right team, you can have a lot of success with hardware if you're diligent up front and you put the work in through the whole process. It's unlike software where you can send something kind of janky out and just fix it with updates. So I think there's some advantages in the hardware space where you just the designs are a little more refined up front, which is good. So I don't know. You talk to investors, they just burn money. They just take dumpsters and fill it full of money for software startups that just like evaporate money like crazy. And like for us, I think we're in $10 million or so, or $11 million over 7 years, and we delivered a product that you can go buy today in a fraction of the money that they're just burning up on like pure software plays. I don't know. I'm all over the place on that, but yeah, I think with the right team, it's not terribly challenging.
Yeah, thanks very much.
I wouldn't recommend a software person that's kind of been used to like, and I experienced it actually going back to Valve. I kind of didn't want to go work at Valve because I wasn't sure they had the discipline to do hardware. And it was a little painful for them because there was a little bit of this dynamic in there where the hardware team that we put together, we had to educate them. They were like, well, the Silicon Valley move fast, break things mentality doesn't work in hardware, right? And they had a little bit of that mentality. It's just like, well, we can ship a Gen 1 and then we'll just flip to a Gen 2 and a Gen 3. It's like, no. Hardware, you don't get that many chances. I mean, look at what's happening right now. I love following hardware startups and see how they do. It's like you got Humane AI Pen came out. You only get one chance, right? Rabbit AI, another one.
Exactly.
You can't go half baked. Not that we're fully baked, but we're mostly.
Totally agree with you on those products and the different approaches. So Jerry, your diverse skills and experiences are truly fascinating. How do you primarily identify yourself and in your professional journey? Do you see yourself as a hacker, a CEO, an engineer, or perhaps something entirely different?
That's a good question. I've always had an entrepreneurial spirit. Even as a child, I dreamed about it, although I didn't have any outlets to be an entrepreneur. My first career right out of high school was a professional race car driver and chassis builder, which is an interesting side to me. But, I learned a lot during that time. Besides just doing the activity of racing the car or the engineering of building the car, there was a wide variety of things I had to quickly learn, like how to promote yourself, how to go raise money. You have to raise money to race a car from. So from a pretty early age, my teens, I was starting to exercise all these muscles of everything that I needed to do in a startup. And when I had my computer stores, I learned a lot during that. It's like how to assemble a team. I was super naive. I was in my 20s. I'd never hired anyone before. And, the burden that's on your shoulder having people, that you have to make sure you make payroll all the time and you have to have the best people and you have to get the bad people off. That was all like tough lessons I had to learn and how to identify them. So, and then going into engineering, this was like, in Silicon Valley, since I didn't go to school, there was a big magnifying glass on me all the time, right? Was I up for the challenge, or was I disciplined enough or good enough? So in the early days of Silicon, you doing working with startups, I would work extremely long hours. Like, if I didn't know something to solve their problem, I would be up all night working on it to make sure I delivered a good, like, piece of engineering to them, which was helped me learn what good engineering looked like, working with great mentors and doing it myself through pure brute force. Anyway, I think that molded me into this weird, multifaceted person where, the business side of things, going back to Castair, my startup that I had trouble in, my biggest mistake I made was I should have just ran it. I'd run, two fairly successful businesses before, the racing business and the computer stores where I had multiple stores and lots of personnel. But I got scared because, a venture-backed startup just felt so different to me. And it turns out, running Tilt 5, it's like, oh, it's muscle memory. I remember that. It's just like, assemble a great team. Make sure you always have cash in the bank. Like one of my mentors told me, like at the start of this, like startups don't fail, because their, products aren't the best. They fail because they run out of money, right? So there's a lot of successful startups that didn't have the absolute best product. They
Just
just managed to have enough money to make it through all the ups and downs where the other products fizzled away.
the Y Combinator is just don't die mantra.
Oh yeah, Y Combinator. I envy folks that get to go through Y Combinator because if you become their favorite, they can just ramrod you through, multiple rounds of big investment, which sometimes turns out good and sometimes turns out like huge dumpster fires full of burning money. And that's also, dynamic of venture capital. They're only looking for 1 out of 10 or 1 out of 12 to like go big. So, and that's always been a little bit hard for me to get my head wrapped around because so many things in my life, it's like I don't eat, next week if I don't do a good job running my store or, sell some race cars or, do a great job on this engineering. So I don't pattern match the confidence over competence, they say, founders that raise lots and lots of money. I'm a little more pragmatic. It's like a little bit more methodical of the steps I take.
Totally agree. So, Jerry, what are your thoughts on the current state of AR and VR markets and where it's headed?
Yeah, I'm a kind of aficionado of technology. So like if you ever come by our office, it's a museum here. We have a room dedicated to Atari era, and it's all like early 70s and early 80s computers and Ataris and ColecoVisions and stuff like that. And we have a Nintendo room. We have vintage computers and rocket parts and I love to look back in history of like emerging markets of like how did they develop? And nothing develops overnight. And that's people forget that. And I think us in the XR bubble, like we're first to ignore or forget that things take a long time to develop. Like jumping out of Valve when VR was so hot, people were making predictions that it would be like a $40 trillion business in 3 years. And it's like no industry has ever grown like that, right? Maybe AI will. I mean, maybe, but I'm even doubtful of that. But you look at how long did it take to get a cell phone in everyone's pocket? It was like 40 years. It started off with kind of janky, like big giant things you installed in your car, and then it got a little less clunky. It was like a big brick that you held, and then you got your flip phones. And each time you make those little incremental steps, which can take like decades sometimes, the total addressable market gets bigger and bigger, and then pretty soon everybody has one. Computers the same way. It's just basically everything develops like that. And I think XR is in that state right now. We went through the hype. Everyone thought it was going to be trillions of dollars in a year or two. When I think we're past the trough of disillusionment. We're on the long tail, as they say, where it's the tail of adoption. And I think the successful way for this market to evolve is there's got to be a lot of different permutations of technology that solve problems in different vertical markets, like computers, early days of personal computers. There was business-centric ones. There were like mini computers for medium-sized businesses. There were really low-cost devices for the like home users that just played video games on them. And there's a lot of money to be made in that period. And out of that, you get the Apples and the big companies emerge out of that. So I think XR, like we're, before we start to see like a winner, it's probably another 20 years. Like we're into it a decade now. So
More
who's
than a
going to be the
decade,
next
right?
Apple? Hopefully us, but the funny thing is, looking back on history too, and this is something I have to field all the time talking to investors, is they're like, how do you defend yourself from Google? And it's like, or Apple or whoever. And it's like the same way we defend ourselves from General Electric, Zenith, Raytheon, whatever, insert giant company that should have owned, markets years ago. We defend ourselves by, being more nimble, more focused, adapting to, the market. I look at the Apple Vision Pro. I think it's a really cool piece of device. But like Apple's bar is so high that it's almost impossible to reach, right? Apple would unlikely make a product like ours. This is just almost impossible for them to make a product like that. They have to make something that, is they're trying to do these moonshots, as they say. And you don't always stick the landing on a moonshot. And I don't think they're quite doing it. And no one's quite any of these moonshot projects, Google or Microsoft, none of them really stuck the landing yet.
Yeah, totally agree. So, Jerry, you talked about AI a bit. Right now, the biggest trend is, of course, AI and generative AI. What do you think about today's AI hype? Is it real or it's another bubble?
I'm mixed. I use AI a lot. One of my favorite things to do on the weekends, actually develop little applications for our system just because it's fun. I come from a background where I've mostly done electrical engineering and optical engineering, stuff like that. So I'm not really a programmer. So I use, ChatGPT to write lots of Unity scripts for me, and it's like I think it's amazing. It's usually kind of terrible in some ways, but I don't care because I'm just trying to prove something out. And a lot of times I make a thing over the weekend and I'm like, hey, team, look what I made. And I made it really fast. And then they like starts, grabbing their head and going, oh my goodness, like now we're gonna have to clean this up because it actually is, interesting. But the I think it's an amazing tool. I don't see how it's going to be particularly useful to everyone on the planet yet. It's not like a phone, right, that basically everyone has. And I think the challenge we're going to have is it feels like it's going to get to like 90% correct pretty quick. And it's that last 10% where it's going to be really hard for an end user to know if you're getting a correct answer or a wrong answer out of it. I think that's going to be really painful, really painful.
Awesome. So, what current tech trends and industries you're most excited about?
Well, from a Tilt 5 perspective, like we love games, like our DNA is games. So we're very pleased with, our product that we launched that's in that market. But we've seen a lot of like adoption of our system in education and training and, more industrial uses. And that's actually surprised us a little bit. We kind of thought it would happen, but not to the degree it's been happening in the last handful of years. And thankfully, like Apple and all the big companies have laid their cards on the table, and industries are starting to see the value of our system, where you can buy like a dozen of ours for the price of an Apple Vision Pro, and most of the other headsets. It's constrained with what you can do with it, like a wall experience or a table experience. But we're selling a lot of units into that. So I'm glad to see that trend is, waking up for us. Outside of us, I'm starting to see more application-specific XR devices, like start to look like they're going to take off. I'm starting to see like information displays that really feel like they've, have some uses. Like, for instance, Google Glass, it was widely panned when it came out, and I thought that was really unfair, but it was kind of their own doing. Like the way they marketed it, it's like it, I felt it could have a lot of utility. Like, figure out how to make the thing for a few $100. You keep it in your pocket. You pull it out when you need some like heads-up display of your text messages or some navigation. You put it back in your pocket. But I'm starting to see companies that are making things for like sports and, different activities that are very specific for that, motorcycles, and kind of in that sweet spot where it's like sub $500 and you can just get it and it just solves some problems for you. I mean, going back to like computers and stuff, like computers were such a rare thing in the 70s. And, you started to see computers popping up in kind of niche vertical markets all over the place. You started to see them show up in cars and trucks and grocery stores for like checkout, barcodes. And, a lot of times people kind of like miss that, that the invention of the microprocessor like opened up lots of opportunities. I think XR is the same thing.
Hopefully. Yeah, of course.
It seems like a natural evolution. Like there's, that's why I'm so excited about it. It's like you can't put any more pixels on my phone. Like I cannot perceive. You can't give me a better camera. Like the cameras are so good now. Like what feature are they going to add to a phone? Like I need something that's,
Some emojis.
I don't think slathering AI onto my phone is going to make me go out and buy the next iPhone. So, I need something else that makes my life better.
Exactly. Totally agree. So, Jerry, what advice would you give to other startups, especially hardware startups, trying to bring innovative products to the market?
Good question. I think, just kind of reflecting on the recent months' news of companies like Rabbit AI and AI, Humane AI Pen, is do the work up front and see if you can validate, even if it's thought exercises, what kind of product market fit can you prove before you put your features into the product? And having worked in the toy industry, and this is kind of a mantra with the toy designers, is it's like less is more in most cases. So, who are you going after? Who is your target audience? In it, what are you trying to solve? And what's the bare minimum you can put into your product to solve that problem or delight them or whatever your objective is. Like in the toy industry, I've had multiple conversations with folks there. They're like, we don't care about the technology. Like most of the toys I did were electronic toys, but they're like, we don't care. You're in the business of making money, and it could be the product could be made completely out of wood. And if it, solves the problem and is profitable,
That's cool.
it's low risk. Go for the hunk of wood over a bunch of transistors and LEDs and stuff like that. And I think when you look at the Til 5 product, also you see that it's like, as much as I get excited about like metamaterials and holographic combiners and all of this stuff that I could be, having our team engineer in, I always have to ground myself in like, adding more adds more risk, adding other technology adds other limitations. Like, what's that balance?
Awesome. Great. So, Jared, can you share any details on Til-5's future product roadmap or plans for the new features, capabilities, etc.?
Being a aficionado of history and technology history, there's a thing called the Osborne effect. This was a computer company in the 70s and early 80s that made a very innovative computer, and they released it to a lot of fanfare, but they made one vital mistake when they introduced it. They said, here's the Osborne 1 computer, just wait until the Osborne 2 computer. And they cannibalized all their sales for the Osborne 1 and bankrupted themselves. So, as I look at other companies in our space, like Facebook, who Osborne affect themselves all the time, they release Quest 2 and they start talking about Quest 3. I refuse to talk about features that we're going to add into our second one. But one thing, we do talk about this a lot, and obviously we're developing future products. One of the things that we feel strongly about is things need to be compatible both directions. So whatever we do, like if you invest in a Gen 1, we want to make sure it works that direction, and we also want to make sure it works that direction as long as we can. There, I mean, there might be a time at Gen 3 where we have to break, Gen 1, but our goal is to always make sure the product is going to be compatible up the full stack. So, what we're doing as far as I can talk about that's pretty exciting is we're working with partners for doing broader distribution. So, you will be seeing like other people moving the product, in the future. So that's underway. We're also working, in a lot of different vertical markets. So there's going to be a lot more content that's not necessarily gaming that you're going to start seeing available. Like we're very interested in getting the device into schools all over the world. It really does well in schools. So we're partnering up to make that happen.
Awesome. That's great. So, Jerry, where can our listeners find out more about you and Tilt 5?
Yeah, it's easy to find me and find Tilt 5. So tilt5.com, you just spell it all out. So you can takes you there. We are doing a sale right now, which is exciting,
Awesome.
for a couple more weeks. So if you buy a three player pack, it's like your best value. It's about $180 a headset. The great thing about our product is the way we designed it. There's like plenty of margin for us to be able to do things like this. So it's, and then to find me, probably two of the best places to find me is to find me on Twitter. So it's just my name, Jeri, and then Ellsworth, Ellsworth. And then LinkedIn's also a pretty good place to reach me on more of a professional level.
Awesome. You also have a great YouTube channel. I found
Oh,
out
yeah.
recently about it.
Yeah, I haven't put too much up there recently. I did do some of my weekend coding up there. That was fun. I should do that again. I did a couple live streams. It's so funny. My YouTube channel, I started it. I was working with a company way back in the mid-2000s that was making a box that streamed video. Back before we could do this, even. Like, it was dedicated hardware to stream video one direction. And so YouTube was brand new. And I'm like, well, I should just kind of learn about the industry I'm working in. So, since I've always been into hobby science, like, how far can you push technology in your home garage? I started just doing all kinds of crazy stuff, like making my own semiconductors and chips in my garage, and various like chemistry or electrical engineering stuff. And recently I did some Tilt5 programming. But a kind of a funny thing is, like, and I did art on there too. Like, I've done some art projects. What's funny is, like, when you get such a strange group of people following you, whenever you do something different, if I do like art, then all the science people are like, ah, you're wasting my time. Or yeah, I get in there and I use ChatGPT to make a really janky game. People are like, oh, I've lost all respect for you. Like, it's very funny. I find my YouTube channel a very funny place to be.
Great. Well, Jerry, it was an honor having you on the All
That was
Things
so
XR
fun.
podcast.
So fun.
Thanks very much.
I'm glad you let me ramble. Take everything I say with a grain of salt. Like, I'm by no means, an expert in business. In 10 years, I'll look back and be like, oh, how naive I was for thinking all that stuff.
That's the evolution. Thanks very much, Jerry.
Thank you. Thank you so much.